Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And today we are talking about the world of books and reading as represented in books and movies and TV shows on the occasion of, well, really now on the occasion of the victory by Cord Jefferson
Yes.
and the American Fiction team for their Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. Congratulations to you for almost having the courage to pick that. You didn't quite, but you almost did.
Just a little dithering.
Yeah, there, you know, this. I gave you every chance to just mount the podium, and you just spit the bit. Now, I guess you're in the horse Olympics now. I don't know where my metaphors are going
it
here.
It should have. I was in the camp of it should have won, but yeah. I really thought that Oppenheimer was going to sweep the Oscars in a bigger way than it did.
Yeah.
I'm glad that it didn't win absolutely everything. And Cord Jefferson had a nice little moment there on stage, encouraging the Academy and the industry to make more movies, give more people shots. And I've been thinking so much about how it's like an inverse of the problem we have in publishing, where we talk about there's too many books all the time. There are too many books. And Cord Jefferson was going, you know, a $200 million movie is a big chance to take. What if you did $54 million movies and gave more people more, you know, times at bat to just tell their story and you know, go for it, which I would love to see happen in movies. I don't know if it's going to, but there's only, I think I heard on The Big Picture, there's only like 125 movies coming out in wide release this year. And we're going to get more new books than that, like in the time that you and I are spending recording this podcast.
We have talked about it before. You could reasonably, without too much effort, see all of those movies eventually. Like that's two a week. I can do that,
two
right?
to three a week, yep.
If you didn't, you know, that's easy. You could, if you read two books a week, which I do a little bit more than that, I still feel like I have not even scratched the surface of the iceberg to that degree.
I know. I do just about two a week, two books a week. And every time I listen to a movie podcast, I think, why didn't I do this with my life? Because they can get, you can see two movies each. You could talk about, we could talk about four movies a week if we divided and conquered and saw two each. And we barely scratch the surface when we're talking about books. And we do this more than most.
We do.
Just really interesting. But yeah, I was delighted to see Cord Jefferson win. I heard Percival Everett was at the Oscars. We had a message in our inbox from a Patreon member saying, how come he wasn't up there on stage? And my best guess is he wasn't involved in the writing of the screenplay, from what I can tell. Jefferson did the adaptation himself, and you know, if you're there but you're not a nominee, you don't get to sit close enough to rush the stage when they call your name. So I'm sure he's celebrating as well.
Two Oscar follow-up things, one by way of transition, one by way of just noting it, is the same Big Picture podcast we both listen to, shouts to Amanda Dobbins and Sean Finnis, who do a great job over there. They did an episode about how the voting works in the Oscars, which I thought was really fascinating. And basically each branch votes for their award. Plus, you can vote for Best Picture. So if I am a member of the Academy in the screenplay and writing awards, I guess I probably get to vote for both adapted and original. I would guess that's the case, though I don't know that for certain. And then I get to vote for Best Picture. Well, the nominations and voting processes can be swayed heavily by that subgroup, right? So it makes sense that a book about writing, or excuse me, a movie about writing, maybe especially appeal to writers. Now, I might be getting my cables crossed. I don't know, by the time the finalists are picked, is that open to the entire body? But I know at least the nominations are specific to that branch. So that's where you get some weird nominations and other things they may not know, because those are specialists and they are swayed by different things than, you know, dummies like us, or even the wider dummy Academy population might be voting for. Also, a name that, words that did not come out of Cord Jefferson's mouth were the words Percival Everett, which I thought
I noticed. I did think he was, I thought Jefferson seemed mostly prepared for his thank you speech, but also pretty flabbergasted that he had won.
Yeah.
And he was up there doing, you could see him doing the mental math of like, wait, 200 million, if you do 50 of those, how many is it? I was a little surprised that he didn't mention Everett's name as well, but you know, I also have no idea what would successfully come out of my mouth were I to be put on the spot like that, no matter how good
my intentions
would be.
I don't know. I guess if I'm, listen, I am not an Academy Award winning screenplay writer nor director, so I'm sure they can do things I would never think of in a million years. If I were in that room and I had a note card with anything on it,
yes,
it would have,
thank the writer.
It would have Michelle, sorry, and it would, and my family, and then Percival Everett would be, and I probably, there's agents on the thing, but again, this is what we do. I'm just shocked. And I'm too, it's too bad because we were talking about the season of Everett, and I still think it is going to be.
Yes,
there's a beautiful long profile in the New Yorker dropped yesterday. The reviews of James are starting to come out. Maybe I'm overthinking this. I think that his name being said in that broadcast that was watched by 20 million people matters in that discourse. And I think it's just a damn shame.
I agree. It was the names of all the authors of the original texts were mentioned when the nominees were read. But I do think that it's more impactful for the audience when you get to hear the winner say the thing. And then you can pick up your phone and Google to get your copy of Erasure.
Oh, that's based on this book, and I can get it today?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's available wherever?
And, you know, Everett has been with Grey Wolf for most of his career up until James, which is coming out from one of the big PRH imprints, from Doubleday. And I noticed, like, the copy of Erasure that I bought back in the fall is a paperback with a pretty nondescript cover.
Yes.
It's a red cover with black text. It says Erasure. And it doesn't look to me like there's going to be a movie poster cover edition of this. And I also think that is a damn shame. Now, Grey Wolf is a nonprofit publisher. We don't know anything about what's going on behind the scenes with Everett's transition to PRH. But it seems like a lot of money left on the table if you're Grey Wolf and you've got an author who has a huge Academy Award winning adaptation of their work out. Why is there not a version of this book with Jeffrey Wright's beautiful face on it and says, you know, the film American Fiction is based on this?
Two thoughts about this. One is I cannot recall, though that doesn't mean anything except for my recollection, movie or adaptation covers where they change the name getting a new cover, because that is confusing. I do think that's confusing. Now, can you put a giant sticker on there? That's fine. I have also been disappointed because I've been looking around and, you know, we talked about, we've been thinking about the adapted screenplay because we were guessing it and I wrote about adapted screenplay for the deep dive. I've been disappointed to see at my beloved Powell's, at Barnes & Noble, there's not a table with here are the nominees. American Prometheus sold copies when that movie came. People would like to
all
know
summer.
This.
The Marnamus,
people would buy these if they were up front in a table. And maybe I'm sure they know their business better than I do. That doesn't mean I can't be disappointed by A, maybe I don't, and B, even if that's the business, I would like to have the table out there. Here are the books the nominees are based on. Go check them out.
Yes,
like those would move
I
units.
Agree.
Anyway.
They would. And I noticed even when I went to see American Fiction in the theater, it was a full house and the lights came up at the end and the woman who was sitting next to me started chatting with me. And I mentioned, I just read the book that this is based on. And she said, oh, I had no idea that it was based on a book. And that made me think, oh, right. There's nothing that even flashes on the screen. I'm sure Everett's name is somewhere in the credits or maybe it's in the opening credits, but folks aren't paying that much attention at that moment. And the fact that this is based on a book has just not been touted in the way that if I were the publisher or Percival Everett, I would want it to have been.
Yeah, I think Percival Everett's probably doing okay right now. He's tenured at, I mean, you read that New Yorker profile. Yeah. I think Percival Everett is maybe exactly where he wants to be. I'm not sure he really wants to be anywhere, but he's an interesting figure that I think the New Yorker profile does a really good job of.
Yeah,
just bring me back to my best half-baked idea, which is we need bookstores and movie theaters.
I agree.
And you know what? I'll amend this. I was thinking about this because this is what my brain does, and I'm sorry to myself and the world at large. My daughter and I were walking to the grocery store, and the Girl Scouts had set up their table. You know, it's Thin Mint season. I was like, you know what? We don't even need a bookstore. The Baghdad Theater down the street from me is showing Dune 2 and Dune 2 only. All you need is a folding table with copies of Dune.
You
don't need a bookstore.
Need a pop-up.
Yes.
I agree.
And you know what? You could also put on that table Erasure by Percival Everett. An American... you could move unit. Anyway, all right, fine. They're leaving
Poor
money on the
Things
table.
By Alistair Gray.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Poor Things is going to come up in this conversation here and again. Okay, let's take a quick sponsor break. And we're going to... So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about American Fiction, the movie. We're going to talk about Erasure, the book. We're going to talk about what our favorite media representations of books, the book world are, and then what are the strengths and weaknesses of those representation. So we're going to go in that order. But first, let's do a sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by K.T. Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant rivals to lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric, and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by K.T. Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
You had this a little bit in reverse order. I'm going to flip it on you to say, let's do what are, well, maybe I'm wrong about this. So we have two segments to do here. One is our actual books, movies, TV shows. And then the other segment is sort of a meta discussion about what gets right or wrong and on screen or off screen. Which do you think is more interesting to start with? Do we start with specific or do we start with the general?
I think the specific is a way into the general. So yeah. Maybe let's start with the specifics and then we can hang lanterns on, and this is a theme that we'll see running across this kind of media.
I picked five things. One of is nonfiction. The rest are fictional. Not all of them are okay. Novels. How would you like to proceed? What do you have on your docket?
I've got three movies and a TV show.
No books for you. Okay. Did Erasure okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Oh, the brief that I had in mind was the best movies and shows about books and publishing. So I did not think about books and publishing. But well, let's just be expansive here, Jeff. Tell me.
Well, a couple of my, I mean, so I'm putting Erasure American Fiction in the canon of this. I guess, yes. I don't know if we want to have that conversation now, but I think it now, it won the Academy goddamn award. Yes. I mean, what else do you need to do? I guess you could win a best picture or something like that, but I don't see that happening in time soon. So I have that number one now with The Bullet for all the reasons we can get into when we talk. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll talk about American Fiction and Erasure specifically at the end after we've done this kind of things, because I think it runs circles around any other representations. And frankly, everything else, including me, personally, yeah. is as wily and crafty and as cunning as any writer yes. you are likely to meet. And they are more cunning than any writer, the most cunning writer you can think of is likely to meet. So that's how meta I'm getting with Percival Everett. My personal favorite, and this is, and so I'm out of, that goes here, is Wonder Boys by Michael Chabon, and then also the movie directed by Gus Van Sant, starring Tobey Maguire, Robert Downey Jr., Michael Douglas, Katie Holmes, and others. It's a rare thing. It's both a campus book, movie, and a publishing book, because Grady Tripp, Michael Douglas's character, is a MFA-er. He's a bad MFA-er, to coin a phrase, right? Where he's got one book under his belt. That was like a yeah, right. That is a really good t-shirt. They should show that at AWP in LA
at
next
Iowa.
Year. So, you know, he's got one novel under his belt that was a finalist. It won the Penn Award. Called The Arsonist's Daughter, which is just an amazing fake book title for something mm-hmm. that won the Penn Award. And that's it. And Robert Downey Jr., this was before his Iron Man. This is 2000, so this is almost 25 years ago this movie came out. Robert Downey Jr. in his, still maybe in rehab, but he's not Tony Stark yet, doing wonderful Robert Downey Jr. things. I think Tobey Maguire did this to cleanse his palate between Spider-Man movies in this era. Mm-hmm. And Michael Douglas, you know, he's doing The Game. He's still a huge star.
So good.
Katie Holmes, you know, I think is fresh in Dawson's Creek getting movie roles. And it's about writers. It's also Robert Downey Jr.'s agent. And it's tangentially about the world of publishing. Rip Torn plays an amazing elder statesman writer who praises Grady's prediction of a bald cypress tree, which is a really funny thing to do. And it's warm and funny and dark and strange and specific. And I think it has a very like down low version of mid-list and below publishing and what it's actually like. These are not glamorous people doing not glamorous things for not very much money, generally speaking. Yeah. And I think everything that Wonder Boys does right about publishing is my critique of most other representations of publishing, which is fancy offices, stiletto heels. Yep. It looks like Devil Wears Prada, but, you know, with books. And that's not what, and maybe there are rooms I haven't been in publishing, and I'm sure, and I know there are. But I even think the rooms next to the rooms I've in don't look like Meryl Streep's got a badass haircut and is, you know, wearing $5,000 shirts.
Yeah, I agree. This one was on my honorable mentions list. Wonder Boys lives like more as a campus movie and an academia kind of movie in my heart than it does being about books and publishing. But I completely agree that it represents a much more common experience of being a published author than anything that we see in the like shiny, glamorized, glittery versions of it. Mm-hmm. Because it's not shiny and glamorous and glittery, and that can be tough for, you know, selling something
right.
that's supposed to be beautiful or, you know, kind of mysterious on screen. But Chabon is like, you know, not interested in that angle. He's interested in sort of like the real lived in world of a story and of those people. I really love Wonder Boys. It's on our list. We will do some kind of Wonder Boys adaptation.
25 years next year. Yeah, we got to do it next year.
Yeah, that's on the list for
all
next
right,
year.
All right, you go for one or two.
Okay. My jokey, but also not jokey, favorite representation is Elf.
I wondered about this.
When we watch Elf, I just sit there thinking, how many people think this is the way publishing works?
Was there one like, minute of research done into publishing for that movie? I think probably not.
Right. First of all, James Caan doesn't even have a computer. It is 2003 in that movie. It's also Christmas Eve. Publishing shuts down on like December 15th every year and does not reopen until after the new year. And also, this is not how publishers get stories. Publishers are overloaded with slush piles. Like the mailroom is probably a pretty accurate representation of publishing. Like, it's just shoots filled with pieces of paper from writers who want you to publish their books. And so this idea of, like, we need a concept for a children's book, and you have these two, like, on-staff writers that are supposed to do it, and also they have no ideas, and so you're going to bring in a consultant like
Kyle
Peter
Gass
Dinklage,
and Andy Richter are hilarious in an undersung role are, in that. They're just like bumbling fools. That is amazing.
Right, but what if it's a peach?
Vegetables are out.
Yeah, so good. And Peter Dinklage does such wonderful things with the Miles Finch character. But like, I am sure that there are people making money being publishing consultants. I don't think those people are typically getting hired by publishers. It's usually authors who are looking for, like, how do I make my book more marketable? How do I make myself more appealing to an agent? If a book gets published and it's missing pages and the children love the books, like, you're going to have to make up for that or do a reprint or something. But just like nothing about the way that business works is accurate to publishing. And every year I'm just like, this is so funny. We watch it every Christmas. I think about it every time. And, you know, it's not a movie about books and publishing, but it's James Caan is spending his life there. Maybe the most accurate piece of it is that publishing employees are typically overworked and on the edge of burnout, but they don't live in apartments that look like that apartment James Caan is living in, unless Mary Steenburgen is making bank. Because, what do you think? He's the senior editor, like...
Maybe the publisher, because his boss comes in. His boss turns out to be the villain of the movie, right? That and people don't believe in Santa. I think his boss owns the company, and then probably Caan is publisher, executive editor, or something like that. So, it's a funny representation that has almost nothing to do with anything related to the world of books and reading. I guess I'll go next. I'll go to the book side. We're talking about Tia Williams of late because her new book is out. But I read 7 Days in June shortly after it came out. And it's a romance set in the world of books. Two writers who had a thing. I don't want to spoil too much of it. But it's writers and they go to a panel. I think probably it's supposed to be the Brooklyn Book Festival. I don't think it's called that. They had a thing. They then share the same editor, which is convenient. I think Cece is the name of their mutual editor and is a wonderful character. And I was reminded of it. I haven't read all the books on this list, but there is a Book Riot list of best novels set in the world of publishing. I'll put in the show notes there. Great job by Allison Doherty. And she reminded me in that this person was both of their editors. I thought it was just one of theirs. But it's a good representation. It's fun. I think it's probably more... I mean, writers writing about publishing makes more sense. Like, they're not going to just shamelessly go off script. I think, like, Favreau probably did with Elf. I think Favreau actually wrote that, if I remember correctly.
He did, yeah.
So it's a rom-commed version of publishing, which is, what do you also even expect in a rom-com? But it's really good. It's a fun read. It's called 7 Days in June by Tia Williams. I do recommend that if you like both romances and are interested in the world of
I completely forgot about the publishing angle of that book. I really liked that one. I guess one from my list that is both a book and a movie, but the movie lives larger in my cultural imagination, is Bridget Jones's Diary. She works at Pemberley Press, which is a nod to Pride and Prejudice. The book and the movie, of course, are kind of thinly veiled inspirations, transformations of Pride and Prejudice. She's got a crush on her boss, Daniel Cleaver, played by Hugh Grant. The book came out in 96. The movie is out in 2001. And Bridget Jones is like the harried cardigan wearing, kind of, you know, perpetually dropping her folders full of paper publishing employees, like a little bit closer to reality. just the level of stress on junior
and mid-level
publishing employees.
It's just about how much is put on their plate.
Yeah, exactly. Most of the folks that I have known in publishing in these last 15 years are very competent and
extremely
really love
competent,
what they do, but tend to be very overloaded. And as we talk about every year when the PW salary survey comes out, they're not getting paid a whole hell of a lot to do that work. So also there's a lot of side hustling going on. You're tired when that is the way that life is put together. And Bridget Jones is also a mess, but that has nothing to do with the fact that she works in publishing. That's just Bridget. So I like that. Those Pemberley Press offices also way too fancy for books and publishing. And it's also like the setup that she's got this big crush on her boss is, I think, also a story that we're not going to get now post Me Too, especially in any way that Daniel engages with it.
No, that's a good point.
because this is inappropriate, but we were not talking about that, you know, 1996.
Let's see. I'll go with, you know, this book was kind of a big deal when it came out, and I don't actually have the publication date. I'm going to do a quick click to see if I can find it. Am I one click away? Yeah, I guess it's been 3 years now, 4 years. Luster by Raven Mulani. Mm-hmm. She's the main character, is a junior assistant editor, another children's book publisher. Assistant editors and children's book publishings get much more shine than you would expect in the world.
They really do.
She doesn't like it. And it's, you know, it's about a lot of the things, you know, related to issues in erasure in American fiction. I think even more related to Other Black Girl, which we didn't particularly care for. I think I like Raven a little bit better than Other Black Girl. Other Black Girl is also set in the world of books and reading, publishing executives. That one has a, well, it has an unusual twist, let's put it this way. Luster gets real messy, but I think it has no specfic elements, if I remember it correctly at this point. And it's satirical and funny and biting. And I think it's the kind of book, I guess it, one weird thing to watch American fiction now and reread Erasure is we have books like Luster and The Other Black Girl now, which we did not, to my knowledge, I shall say, in 2000. So there's an and I guess we can save this for the American, but there's an element to the core thing of the film of American fiction that feels a little dated to me, honestly. I feel it feels a little dated in a way that the book Erasure is not, for reasonable talk. But one of the reasons is, and I don't know if, I'm sure a lot of these people writing books about publishing know of Erasure or Everett, especially if they're black writers, I think they would maybe know more about this particular story. But we've gotten sort of second wave stories about black people in publishing. It took longer than it should have, but there's actually quite a few of them at this point, which is great, but there are a bunch of them.
Yeah, that jogged my memory of a book I read last year, or in the last couple of years, called The Neighbor Favor by Christina Forrest.
Oh, I remember
it's a little
talking about
rom-com.
This. Yeah,
yeah, really, it's just like a sweet little rom-com. She wants to be a children's book editor, but she's working for like a very stodgy nonfiction imprint, and writes a, like, is on the train in New York when there's a blackout or a stoppage or something, and she kind of goes into this like fever dream state, and while she's wasting time, she goes to her favorite author from childhood's website and sends a message about, you know, how much she loved the work and how it changed her life and it's inspiring her to pursue her dreams working in publishing, and they start up a pen pal ship. She never knew that the writer's publishing name was a pseudonym, and that he is also like a relative. He was very young when the book came out, and so they are about the same age, and they eventually, you know, solve this. It has little You've Got Mail flavor of like you're corresponding with someone and you don't know who they actually are, and then they're falling for each other. But she is also a young black woman working in publishing, and it's, the book's not about her experience or in any kind of racialized sense. Doesn't get into the, you know, satirical or the critique of it. But it was, that was really fun, and I would like to see. I think it would make a fun adaptation. I think you're right that American fiction feels a little bit dated, and I also think I wouldn't feel that way if Yellowface hadn't come out last year.
Yeah, that was on my list too. I mean, we've talked about this before, but it's worth mentioning Yellowface. Again, I will take Erasure over Yellowface, if only for metatextual craft inventiveness stuff that we'll get into. But it's coming at a similar angle. It's coming to a similar set of questions from a slightly different angle. Yellowface is the Reese's Book Club version of Erasure. I think that's my simplest way of putting it.
Yeah, I
and
think
there's,
that's right.
There's room for that. That's not a put down. I think one of the things the movie does an interesting job of is thinking about different marketing and registers, and is it bad to give the market what they want if more people read it? So if I did my research, right? What's her name? Sitara Golden is the name of the author, says to Erasure, says to Erasure, to Monk, which is an invention of the movie over the book. But yeah, it's similar. And does Yellowface trod new ground? Yeah, I think it does, especially when it comes to different identities. But you're right. I think a movie version of Yellowface is also an interesting movie. It's differently interesting at the same time. So I'll check Yellowface off my list. What else do you have to
go? I have Younger.
I know. I watched one episode. The one that mentioned Book Riot, that's the only one I ever watched.
Well, it's a premise that you don't love. I mean, your least famous, your least favorite premise is professor and student, but this is boss and employee.
Yeah, same diff.
Sutton, they get around it because Sutton Foster is actually a grown adult. She's just pretending to be.
What a nice sleight of hand by the authors there. Like, we could have the trope that has dynamic, but also we don't have to feel squicky about it.
But she is a junior employee. She's like in her 40s, and her boss is her peer age-wise, but not in terms of the professional
hierarchy.
So
we feel 31% less squicky. Not completely less squicky.
Yeah, the show started in 2015. So like if it had been pitched after Me Too, I don't think this show comes out. But Sutton Foster, Hilary Duff, Debbie Mazar, who does like a wonderful job playing what you think of as a stereotypical Brooklyn artist living in a loft in Williamsburg and being a weirdo, and Miriam Shore as Sutton Foster's boss and like one of the head editors at this imprint. I think it gets right that publishing always feels like it's on the edge of everything falling apart. Like they deal with, everyone is stressed. They deal with like weird budget concerns. They deal with big author egos. And there's a sort of George R.R. Martin avatar character that comes up a couple of times. But also everyone is dressed to the nines. It has a lot of Devil Wears Prada DNA. The offices are very fancy. It's not, in my experience, what publishing feels like, except maybe like the very fanciest book expo party, and in some of the things that some of the small parties like I've heard about, but was never fancy enough to go to. In someone's very fancy apartment. The publisher of some publishing house has a like dinner party for 12 people and everyone knows about it.
Yep. Right.
But Younger was enjoyable. Like I watched most of it when it was out. I don't know if I've seen the whole thing. But it's just regularly in the trenches of publishing. They're in their offices every day. They're having meetings. Like book agents come off looking a lot flashier than any book agent I've ever met. But they did capture, 2015 and then into the later seasons, they did capture, like, when someone goes viral, how quickly a publisher is scrambling to, like, land that person's book deal and not have them go to another house so they can capitalize on the fame that doesn't last very long. So, I mean, that one, it's fun. It's, most of the things that media gets wrong about publishing, it gets wrong about publishing, but it's a good time.
I am going to end my list as sort of a transition to the what these books get right and wrong. So you have anything else you want to knock out before I use my fulcrum pick to move us on?
Oh, sure. I just wanted to mention Young Adult by Diablo Cody, which stars Charlize Theron as a young adult author. She's like coming off a divorce and goes back to her hometown and kind of tries to wreck the home of a guy she had a crush on when she was younger. It reinforces a lot of the stereotypes that go around about adults who read and write YA. I think that a version of it from 2024 would be very different. We have a different and I think better way of talking about young adult fiction now, but that's one. And then it's only tangentially about publishing, but I loved that Sandra Bullock's character in The Lost City is a romance author.
Yeah.
It's just a good time. So that's my short list.
I had thought about doing a draft of I just want characters from these all in the same actual movie set in the world of publishing, because Jack Nicholson, As Good As It Gets, is not related to any publisher. I mean, it's like a Daniel Steele kind of writer factory, but I don't know if he's based on someone, but he is having the time of his life in that as a romance author that, how do you write women so well? I take about reason and accountability, and the movie knows he's being the lovable cad that he is.
Right.
And I think that is a figure, the lovable cad that we give license to because we like what they make. And we kind of want the court jester pointing at us a little bit. I think publishing does that well. But I'm taking Nicholson in that. I'm taking Parker Posey in You've Got Mail. I'm taking I'm taking Sterling Brown in Erasure. I'm taking Debbie Mazar. Let's go. Let's put them all in and we can do Mad Men for FSG, which is my transitional pick. Hot House by Boris Kochka is a nonfiction book about FSG, Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and it is reads like a house on fire. And so the things that make it amazing are the things that are left out of the publishing stuff we get. How insular it is, how there's a few people. Again, I think this is still certainly true in the heydays of FSG and the literary imprints like Knopf and other places. It's insular. It's petty. It's mean. I think one of the phrases that's used either in Hot House or in the blurb is a sexual sewer. The sexual politics are horrible, God. Like worse than Mad Men kind of stuff. And then it also, the way the authors that we think of being on the Mount Rushmore, of Minted, Platinum, these are made by, they're not made by publishers, but they are not made by publishers. And the very brass tacks thing about who gets what review, who gets paid where, who gets what spot. And then also the super important influence, especially from the early 20th century and the mid 20th century, of these family run imprints, many, if not most of them, run by first or second generation Jewish immigrants. Like that doesn't appear in any of these publishing worlds, and how small.
No.
Now, where you now live in the more corporate world, I think one thing that movies, especially in TV shows, tend to do, they confuse Condé Nast with Scribner. Right?
Yes.
They're doing New Yorker, they're doing Vogue, you know, they're doing that kind of stuff and replacing books. And it's a different world completely. I mean, it feels the same, but it's not. Like the archetypal rom-com male lead's job is an architect, and the archetypal female rom-coms is a magazine editor. And it's not a hard switch to think author to architect and editor to editor in books, but it's a really different world.
Yes.
And I think it gets that right. I think the thing that does get right is the Amy Sedaris secretary. It is the Bridget Jones. It is the junior level, let's do everything always, all the time. I'm barely holding this place together. Yeah. And it's only because of their hyper energy, competence, and passion does anything gets done. And you see that in a few places. And I think that's probably the one thing it gets right.
Yeah, there was that piece, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago in PW about sort of an exodus from the big publishing houses, yeah. especially PRH, of longtime folks who had been there for decades. And some of the discourse that I saw around that was younger people being like, finally, I'm not going to have to teach a person who makes five times as much money as I do how to attach a PDF to an email. And that's a real vibe, in especially among junior publishing folks, or it has been historically.
That has to be changing. I mean, I think we're now 15
I would
years
hope so.
In. Eventually, this is going to change. But yeah.
And I think that this is true of most industries, and particularly creative industries, that like the grunt work that holds the whole enterprise together is done by junior people.
Yep.
And that's not stuff that translates into being fun to watch on film or fun to watch on your TV show, unless they can like really dial up the drama in some ways, which I think is one of those reasons that like you get magazine editor instead of like junior book publicist starring in rom-coms. Cause I'm just like, your junior book publicist is just sending out emails all day long, hoping that someone says, yes, I would like to talk to your author.
Right. Yeah. I think and that's probably true of most knowledge work representations on film, is like, it's mostly just sending email and cross inter-team Slack messaging, which makes for terrible cinema. Hot House, by the way, on sale for $4 on your Kindle, or you can get a $6 paperback. I'm looking at Amazon right now, so go check that out. It is really great. Mad Men for the Literary World is the blurb by one Juno Diaz, which is a whole other publishing story, I guess, too.
Yeah, we're not going to get into episode for another day.
Yeah, another day. All right, let's do a second sponsor break and get into Erasure and American fiction specifically.
Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Gillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden. And thanks again to WW Norton & Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is the graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
Where to start? Do you want to start? You want me to start? How do you want to eat this chimera elephant?
Telling me right before we recorded that you reread Erasure last night.
Yeah, so let me.
Go ahead. I read it back in the winter, so I want to hear about the first time you read it and what's different now that you work in publishing.
So the book came out in 2001, I think. I don't have that in front of me. I read it in grad school.
Okay.
Not for grad school, but while I was in grad school. I think it was my first Percival Everett. I was in academia, so it was related, but I didn't know that much about the world of publishing, which is one thing historically literary studies have been bad at, is sort of the material means of production. That's changed since I've been in grad school to some degree. So I had no sense really of what it was talking about, except that Sapphire's book, Push? Is that what it's
Push.
Called?
Mm-hmm.
Push, yes.
Yeah.
Had come out, and I'd read that phenomenon. The movie, I think, had just come out, and it's pretty clearly the book that Everett is writing. And I would be careful with my verb here, because I don't think the verb or the preposition is against. He's writing around this phenomenon to some degree. So I knew about that, and then the thing that, of course, struck me as a burgeoning wannabe literary critic is all the literary play and textual stuff. The stories within stories, you know, the asides, the made up, the text within text, like all, what is this? You know, what are these notes? How am I supposed to relate this note that Monk writes that's like the beginning of a good but maybe bad short story about a woman who gives birth to an egg? What am I supposed to do with that?
Right?
Is that an amazing aside, or is that meant to be a parody of MFA writing workshops? Or is it probably both? And is it also about the fact that it's about both? You see what I'm getting at here. So I was dazzled by that sort of piece. Been a long time. My next experience was then to watch American Fiction and then to reread the book in the light of American Fiction. So I didn't have a fresh memory of the book when I saw the movie. So that's why I went back and reread Erasure over the weekend. So that's kind of where I was.
Okay. Yeah, I've only read it the one time. I read it for the first time back in the winter, right before I saw the movie. And so I knew, like, I had seen the trailer for American Fiction and been like, well, this is going to be amazing.
Right.
And just like put Jeffrey Wright straight into my veins. So when I read it, I knew the general shape that, like, this is about an author who thinks that he is parodying this sort of stereotypical black fiction that he's pushing against in some ways and writing around, as you were saying. I was not expecting there to be like 50 pages of the text.
10
chapters.
10 chapters of my pathology.
Like, I'm sitting there in the airport like, oh, okay, I guess I thought it was going to be like maybe the first couple pages just to give you a taste, but that, like, that Everett writes the whole, basically the whole thing, and or enough of it that we have a real sense of what it is that Monk Ellison had put in the mail to his publisher that day. I was so surprised that that was in there and that he really went for it, that he like shows that much of the process. And I loved being in Monk's head through the book, which is like the thing that I did miss about the movie, which of course interiority is hard.
The hardest thing, film, the thing that books have over movies every single time.
But Monk has this, like, his internal monologue and, like, the conflicted feelings he has, how frustrated he is that he's getting famous off of this thing. And it's, like, the kind of break he's longing for, but it's not for the right thing. It's not for his real work that showcases his real talent. And I think that's another, like, sub thing that this book and movie both get right about publishing is how, like, the super specific academic artsy stuff that people really are invested in, that is a terribly small pond, and it's such a culture of scarcity. Like, maybe one person out of that pond is going to have any kind of big break in your peer group, and everyone is going to hate them because then it feels like, well, they won, and so I'm definitely not. My shot is gone. They got the one, like, decent book deal about this super specific thing that we all study or that we all think about. And that tension that he feels between what he wants people to care about and the recognition of what people actually care about and are actually interested in and will pay money for, and then seeing how it infects even the world of publishing, like, while he's on that National Book Award prize committee. That shit is so funny. It's just so sharp and so well observed. I would love to know more about, like, what Percival Everett and who Percival Everett has observed inside the world of publishing. I'm sure he's been on some prize committees and some really awful conference calls.
Yes.
For that.
Well, think of what those were like in the 80s. I mean, they're bad enough now, I'm sure. I mean, and people have a lot more understanding language terminology that I can't imagine what a phone call in 1990 would have been like.
Right. Would have been terrible. And I thought the film did a good job of, like, it smooths out some of the timeline stuff. It does. We're not so much in Monk's head, but we do get the sense that he feels conflicted about this and, like, wow, what a pickle he's gotten himself into with this situation. And then I thought it was smart for Cord Jefferson to make this really a family movie. Like, I think that's one of the ways that it probably got a lot of votes from the Academy, is a movie that is mostly about the marginalized experience of a marginalized author is appealing, but has a much smaller audience than something that, like, is really a family story that's dealing with big questions and also happens to be about making art and making culture in some way. And, like, it's not in that way true to the spirit of the book. The family stuff really felt secondary to me in the book. But, I mean, just the fact that we get to hang out with Sterling K. Brown so much makes
having
it
the time
totally
of his life looks like a god.
Like, is anyone enjoying their year more than Sterling K. Brown is right now?
I can't imagine that they are. Though Dominic Sessa, plucked from the obscurity of an undergraduate program to getting to be at these places. I remember being dazzled by the book and really not knowing to know what to do with it when I was 23, 24.
Yeah.
And then I watched the movie and enjoyed it. It's like, yeah, that feels like the central premise is easy to remember, right? Stagger Lee, the pseudonym, you know, a representation of a exaggerated version of a real but sometimes too culturally dominant story of Black poverty, trauma, violence, desperation, and you know, woe, the struggle, right? You know, the kind of the classic struggle story. And so I liked the movie when it came out. I thought Wright was great. I just like to hang out with Jeffrey Wright. I like Jeffrey Wright. I don't know what to do with that. That's great. You know, sometimes you like actors. And then I read the book, and I liked the movie a lot less. I didn't like it, but it's only my admiration has only grown. And maybe I can appreciate now what Everett is doing more than I could 20 years ago. So let me say this. When you are reading Percival Everett, and maybe Percival Everett exemplar in this way, be very, very careful about what you think is going on. Not in terms of plot, but in terms of what Everett may or may not be saying about anything at all at any given time. Because the thing that it reminded me of, and bear with me for a minute, I know it's going to be a shock to you, Rebecca, that I thought of a metaphor.
Does it involve agriculture?
Well, it involves trees, so you're going to like this.
Oh, All right,
my
great.
My kids and I used to play a game. There's wonderful parks close to us in here in Portland, Oregon, with these giant trees, big enough where you can hide behind them and then like run around them to stay hidden from. You know, like they're peeking around to find you and you move around to the other side and they still can't find you. My kids love this. This is what Percival Everett is doing to you in Erasure.
Yes.
He's running around the tree just enough for you to get a glimpse of him to keep running in that direction. Then he moves again. And it keeps moving because I think there's no wrong reading. That's the other thing. There's a version of this that there's a message about the danger of a melodramatic, stereotyped, exploitive story of black pain. That's there. I think most people get that. I don't think the thing that most people get is the second move, which is it is also a critique of literary fiction because yes. The story of Monk's family is a literary fiction story trope and stereotype of a bourgeois upper middle class family. Now, again, white is in parentheses, and he's playing with that by having it be a black family who has a gay brother who had a hard time with his parents, who finds a box of letters about the dad's affair, who has a mom. These are all tropes. Yeah. This is a genre of literary
domestic fiction.
Domestic fiction. And the thing Everett, actually, one of the things happening, I'm even careful not to say Everett. One of the things happening is the book is like, notice white stories. They are also tropified. They are also stereotyped. It looks different, and maybe it has different effects, but this is a trope. It just is. And even to the point where some of the things have, like, we have huge money problems. Oh, wait, we also have this beach house on the Cape. Should we sell that? Well, that's probably worth $3 million. We forgot about that. Well, let's go to the beach house for the wedding. And then we can sell it. And then the black family has the maid that's like family who's black. It's like, it's amazing what he's doing. And then it is about writing and language and representation. And so once I got around, this is actually also about literary fiction, but don't stop there. Cause then he moves back around to say,
it's slippery.
It's all about representation. So like and again, in order to do that as a movie, you have to make it about movie making, I think, right. Because he's such a master of text, language, the written arts. He seems to have read everything and knows everything, by the way. Even just his ability to feign the bios of the people, of the other authors,
yes,
demonstrates a mastery of the milieu of a certain kind of writing world that is unparalleled in my experience. I don't know that anyone else does anything like this.
I think that's right. Yeah, nothing is getting by. No. Percival Everett, and it's like four-dimensional chess.
It is
of the highest order. I was just checking what year did the Corrections come out, and the Corrections also came out in 2001. So he wouldn't have been responding to it, but it doesn't need to be the Corrections specifically.
Right.
He's responding to, but it's that flavor.
Yes,
and that is the very particular flavor of like white family domestic drama literary fiction that was big at the time. So I think he's responding to those things. I know when we read Yellowface and we talked about it on the Patreon, we talked about how like Kwong is writing in a way where everyone is implicated. There is no reader who gets like a gold star for their woke participation in publishing through the lens of that book. And I think Everett is doing the same thing, and he's just doing it at like the highest possible level, that it's a look at the system without being a polemic text about a system or multiple systems. But everyone who participates in this, including Monk, who is both exploited and exploiting it, like exploited by it and exploiting it himself, is participating in helping this machine continue to run. And Monk knows that, and Everett knows it too, and Everett knows that he's participating in it as a writer who's commenting on it. There are layers on layers on layers of this thing. It's one of those that I feel like I could reread every year or two, and you just continue to uncover stuff about it. When I was reading it the first time, I was in the airport, and I know I was texting you like, holy crap, why did no one ever tell me about this? There is so much to talk about here. Percival Everett, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, and I don't want to name names, but I saw someone, I don't know if it was on Instagram or Twitter, someone reading this because of American Fiction, like, oh my God, in this middle of this giant satire, Everett gives this amazing description of cutting, of sawing wood, of woodworking, right? Uh-huh. Because one of Monk's, in the books, there's two of them, really. It's trout fishing, fly fishing specifically.
Right.
And I don't know if there's anything more coded as white than fly fishing.
Very white hobby.
Very white. Yeah. And woodworking, which again is sort of this is what, you know, Ron Swanson kind of element of like do-it-yourselfness, but you have to have all these tools, right? And you don't actually have to make anything. It's a very expensive hobby where you make something for no reason and no gain. And someone had screen caps like, look what Everett can do in this description of sawing wood. And I was like, oh my God, he got you in his Venus flytrap. Because that's a parody.
Right.
That's a parody of like, this is the kind of award-winning stuff. And I like descriptions of fly fishing. I've talked about this before.
Right. But you've read several books about this.
Several? Yeah. Several is not enough. That's not the big enough not noun
all of them.
Or adjective for them. And but he's like, he knows that I, you know, kind of a royal eye here for a certain kind of white literary reader, also does that. And he catches me because it is a beautiful description of two different kinds of saw blades. And it feels like it's a metaphor for something, but I don't think it is. I think it's supposed to be sort of a sphinx of like, here, I'm going to trap you with this beautiful, small discussion of something finally observed, and it feels meaningful, but it's just actually kind of describing the realities of two different kinds of saws, and that's it.
Yeah, I think Everett in those moments is just up there pulling the strings and sort of cackling to himself about what he knows we're all doing when we hit those pages, because he is such a great writer that you can sink into it and just, you know, be absorbed by what's going on with Monk and be fascinated and laughing and like seeing the sharpness of the satire and get a little too comfortable.
Uh-huh.
And that's the zone. That's exactly where he wants you to be. Like, this is, I think a flytrap is a perfect analogy for it, because or a spider's web, like he just draws you right in to be like, this is safe and cool and great.
And I get it. And how smart I am, because I see that he's playing four-dimensional chess, but there's actually a secret fifth dimension that you don't know anything about.
Right. If you don't come away from Erasure feeling like a little or a lot unsettled, something has gone wrong.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if you feel like there's a quote unquote singular message, I'd be very careful. And maybe that's my own reading, but I have a lot of admiration. And both of us, probably our favorite reading experience is a stimulating, interesting mess, right?
Correct.
And I wouldn't say this is a mess. I think it's too.
It's too carefully.
It's
masterfully done. Yeah.
I think it's a smorgasbord. Like, it's a mess of food, but it's all out there and available, right? Like, and it's put together in some way. But like, there are a lot of you could pull all of these strings, and the sweater would pull apart, but you would find in your hand a differently reconstituted sweater that you've just pulled apart.
Right. Like, this is not the one I thought I was getting.
It's like, wait a minute, this is actually a different, I can pull this apart and it turns into a different sweater that's about language, or it's about generational trauma. I mean, so many of the familiar stories of many genres collide, collapse, are reconfigured, and are observed here. And I think if you read other Everetts, you will see that he is not a polemical writer. He's not a political writer in a conventional sense. He, I think, is as much interested in writing and language and text as he is in anything else.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I bet we're going to see all of that and then some on display in James. Like, the connection between a writer who writes and thinks this way about language and publishing and whose stories get told and who gets to tell them and what happens in them, and then he picks the very memorable black character from one of the most classic works of American literature to do a spin on, and that comes out next Tuesday. I think I will be relishing some of the reviews and the coverage of this, and we should all assume that everybody is going to miss something, ourselves included. Like, we're all going, like, no one is going to capture 100% of the four-dimensional chess that Percival Everett is playing. But if you want to play it with us, we are going to book club our way through James on the Patreon in an episode that comes out next month. So you can do that there. But I think we'll be continuing to talk about Erasure and what Everett has to say about books and stories as we get into this next one.
Yeah. It's, you know, and in terms of, and so I guess that brings me back to the, what is the achievement of the screenplay? Did, you know, did it deserve it? Everything else like that. I still kind of feel like I would have given it to, I think the Oppenheimer screenplay, again, it's been a while since I've read American Prometheus. I think what it did kept and built, I guess this is the way I'll put it. I'll just put it out there. The screenplay for American Fiction is less than Erasure. It just is. It's just less than what's there for you in Erasure.
Yeah. In the Adaptation Nation construction of you get to keep one, the book or the movie, I'm definitely keeping the book in this case. If we go back to the Oscars, I think I'm actually giving Best Adapted Screenplay, now that I've had my reaction to it, was informative. I think I would have given it to Poor Things.
But you also haven't, I mean, that's the same problem.
That's true.
Anyway, I mean, I'd be curious I'd be very curious to hear. I think there's something similar operating where Alasdair Gray is as much interested in the text and like stories about stories. Like, I think Everett and Gray would get along like a house of fire, or they would hate each other, but the reaction would be fascinating in another way.
It would be a fascinating pairing for something. And Poor Things is on Hulu now, folks, so if you've been waiting, you can watch that at home. Really, really interesting. I have more thoughts related to Oscar stuff, but maybe we should save that for the main
show. we can save that. I think Jefferson, and I'm sure there's other people thinking about this, there's one grace note at the end of American Fiction that I won't spoil, where Monk gives a nod to a character who's playing, he's on a movie lot. And there's someone who's sitting around who looks like he's probably in a period slavery era piece, you know, sitting around in his.
Yeah.
And Monk kind of waves at him, and the guy waves back. And I think Jefferson is nodding to sort of the ongoing complexity that is hard for him to handle. It's just hard to put in. It's just hard to figure out how to. Because the end of this book is an Everettian opening rather than a closure. Yeah, let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah. I think that's right. That's right. And like, an adaptation of this written by Percival Everett becomes an art house movie.
It's not a movie because it's visual, not textual. Like, he can't do it anyway.
And so it has to be adapted by somebody who's making films, I think. And Jefferson made tough choices, but almost no writer is equal to the task. Like, what a huge thing to take on, to try to wrangle a masterful work and to wrangle a writer like Percival Everett into something that can be, you know, that you can take down in 120 minutes on the big screen. I think Jefferson did as good a job as is possible, and American Fiction stands on its own as a really good movie, but as an adaptation of a truly great, pretty singular book.
I think Nope is doing for movies what Erasure was trying to do for books, but that's another hot take. All right. Show notes, bookriot.com/listen. Check out the Patreon podcast. Email us. podcast@bookriot.com. First edition is up and running. Just had a really cool interview with Xochitl Gonzalez. Did two segments with her. One was called Anatomy of a Scene, in which each of us picked a scene from her new book, Anita DeMonte Laughs Last, and talked about it. And then I asked her what the hardest part and the easiest part of the book to write.
We talked about that question.
A lot of fun to go check out there. Good times. Go read Erasure. If any of this was interesting, I promise you Erasure is more interesting than we can describe it. This point.
Yes.
Talk to y'all soon.